don't know why. There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
Hey folks, this is Rish Outfield. And you're listening to the Rish Outcast. And today I am not in the car. Today I am out walking. I've gone to the lake. It's not far from where I live. It's a sunny day. Oh, it's beautiful. It's probably 75 degrees, 76 degrees. And I'm going to present to you a story. And the story could not be less connected with the beautiful sunny day that I'm recording this in. I mean, it's sad because the story is called Stormy Weather. And it's about a snowstorm. There are mountains that I can see in all directions, and they still have snow on them. So I guess that's a little bit more apt. But today, oh, it feels like summer. It feels just wonderful. And I'm going to share this story with you. And I haven't edited the story yet. I have recorded it, and I don't know how long it's going to be. But my fear is that it's a really long story, and we might have to split this in two. But I know that people don't like that as much. And even I don't. I don't like it when I split episodes into two. But, you know, if an episode is longer than an hour, it might as well be split into two. Because I don't know. I'm going from an old idea of how long podcasts could be. Because I remember when podcasts were first invented, people used to say between 20 and like 45 minutes is the best length for a podcast because you can listen to it on your commute, you know, to work or home from work or, I don't know, your lunch hour or the time that you have for a conjugal visit here in the jail. And I believed that. But of course, Big and I had long episodes sometimes. And people liked it. They liked the long episodes. I don't know what the longest episode we ever had was. All I know is we only split like two or three stories in two in all the times that we did the Dunstief. And with my show, it's really just up to me. If I split this in two, that gives me a couple extra weeks to work on it. You know what I mean? And so I probably will split it. So in which case, you've been warned, and I don't know how long the story is. I mean, I do, but I don't know how long the audio is going to be. Because the fact is, sometimes I read slow, sometimes I read fast. Sometimes there's dialogue, and dialogue, you tend to read fast sometimes, especially if it's action-packed dialogue or whatever. You can also pad out an episode with music and sound effects and such. So I don't know. But my guess is the story is at least an hour long. So, Stormy Weather by Rish Outfield. I don't know. It's probably a PG-13. It shouldn't be too offensive, kids. But I'll talk about that sort of stuff after the show. After the story. After the story, the feedback.
Stormy Weather, written and narrated by Rish Outfield. Everybody in town was talking about it. A big storm was on the way. Maybe a snowstorm, maybe a blizzard. Maybe nothing, as the weatherman had predicted heavy snowfall all week, and there had barely been enough each night not to melt off during the day. But there were dire predictions for this upcoming storm, so much that people were making the half-hour drive to Donelson to buy up extra food and supplies, just in case. Jeremy Cooper was one of them. He was mayor of Little Acre, the farming community of 200 or so, and had lived his whole life there. His father had been mayor too, at least for a decade or so, when Jeremy had been a boy. But the town was bigger then. As the years went by, people sold their farms, or moved away, or simply died and weren't replaced by children or new families. In Jeremy's father's day, Little Acres had had a general store, a laundromat, and a bed and breakfast. Now the only thing they had in town was a mechanic's shop and a tiny bar and grill. If the town continued to shrink at this rate, it was conceivable that one day it would revert back to the size of its name. But it was home to Jeremy, and his daughters seemed to love it. His wife Marjorie wasn't so thrilled with the isolation. 20 miles from the next town, farther still from nice stores, restaurants, and entertainment, and cheap property values. He suspected that she'd move out on him the moment the girls left home, if not sooner. But he couldn't worry about that now. He had packed everyone into his old pickup and driven out to Donaldson to buy cereal and bread for the weekend, a book or two for Marjorie, and something fun for the girls. They all went without complaint. It was a bit of an adventure, and he knew the girls had heard scary stories about the storm. Jeremy's own father had told of a blizzard that struck when he was a teenager. The town had been covered with freezing, blowing snow, and 3 people had died. Jeremy had little in the way of responsibilities as mayor, but he was going to be prepared, just in case this storm was like that storm, and he would do what he could to ensure no casualties. Of course, in the 21st century, things were safer. More blankets, more heat, more communication. But he suspected people were weaker nowadays, more dependent on technology and modern amenities, and would be less able to fend for themselves if the worst came. A bit of snow fell as they were driving back, but it was light and wet, and Jeremy wondered if this had all been for nothing, just an excuse to fear the worst and burn through a quarter tank of gas. Marjorie was asleep next to him, and the girls were in the back, Carol reading aloud to Mimi. The wind started to pick up as they headed down the long, straight stretch that led into their little town, and he had to concentrate a tiny bit more on his driving. Still, a bit of wind and a few snowflakes hardly constituted a blizzard. An hour after they'd gotten home, the wind was still blowing, and the snow seemed a touch heavier. Jeremy watered the cows and looked at the gray sky in the distance. If a blizzard did come, he'd have to lock the cows in the shelter, which he really only did when one of them was calving. The chickens could flee to their coop, but he'd have to make sure their water wasn't frozen. He wondered about the old folks in town. Would they have the sense to take care of things, or did they have someone to look after them? Or is that my job? He asked himself. He turned to go back in the house, and suspected he already knew the answer to that. There was no sheriff or police chief in Little Acres. The only authority figures were Pastor Ian, who was less than dependable now that his wife had died, and the lady postmaster, who only worked a few hours every midday, and even then, reluctantly. That left the mayor. Jeremy stomped his boots and came inside. Marjorie was watching the news. There was a severe storm warning scrolling across the bottom of the screen, and they were reporting that up in the hills there had already been a 1/2 foot of snow in an hour. "Sounds like it's coming," his wife said. "They even interrupted Seinfeld."
"That's a bad sign," he said, but he still wasn't convinced.
There was a bad storm prediction every year, and the power hadn't even gone out in 2. "Oh, Peggy Carlson called," Marjorie remembered. "She said her pipes are going to freeze and her heater sucks."
"Sucks," Jeremy repeated. "She's more with it than I gave her credit for."
"Okay, she didn't say sucks. Whatever." Jeremy thought about it. In a blizzard, pipes could freeze, people could get stuck in their homes or vehicles, and cell phone reception was notoriously spotty in town anyway. Only one of the 4 available cellular providers got any signal in Little Acres, and that was only 4 or 5 days a week. One of his daughters, Mimi, was watching at the window.
"Snowing," she sing-songed,
but she was too young to see any danger, only wonder.
"Where's your sister?" Jeremy asked.
"Listening,"
Mimi said, which meant she was on her iPod, in their room, singing, badly, to whatever pretty boy pop group was also singing, badly. An hour later, the wind had increased, and the snow had become a hard, almost painful thing that coated windows and roads. Jeremy went out to the Carlson farm, where Peggy, 70, lived with her worthless grandson, 14, and useless granddaughter, 16. The woman had to answer the door herself, even though both teens were in the living room watching TV. Her furnace was acting up, and though the house had a fireplace, Peggy had no firewood or coal. Jeremy used some old rags to wrap the woman's pipes, but the snow was coming heavier now, and he knew they would freeze no matter what if the storm kept up and the power went out. Shit, Jeremy muttered to himself.
By which you mean shoot,
Peggy Carlson said behind him. Jeremy turned. The old woman was looking at him with concern. She was old enough to have lived here in the days when the last blizzard hit, and maybe she, like him, was thinking of the three people who died. Jeremy did some quick thinking in the minute before he made his decision. Can I use your phone? He called Luke Smithson, who had the biggest farm in town. They were pretty good friends and had been even closer in their youth. Luke knew what the call was about.
Bad storm, huh?
Apparently. News says it's going to get worse.
Yeah, the newscast on Channel 5 just started reading from the Book of Revelations.
What? Jeremy said.
Seriously?
No, Luke chuckled.
What can I do for you, Jerem?
You got the keys to the VFW?
Yeah?
I'm thinking we should get all the folks in town. Gather them at the VFW building. Keep an eye on everybody.
Right now? Luke asked. It could be nothing, you know.
Could be something, too. It'd be a lot easier to collect everybody now, before the roads go out.
If the roads go out.
Right. For a moment, the wind blew so hard that Mrs. Carlson's windows rattled, and there was static on the phone line.
Why the VFW?
Luke was asking. Because it's easy to get to. It's big enough for everybody in town, and we know the heaters work.
But food and water and blankets.
We can have everybody bring plenty. Stock the place up, if need be.
Yeah, all right. That works.
Can you have your family gather up some supplies, just in case?
Wait, Luke said. You want me to go there, too?
Well, yeah. Everybody, if we can. And I'd need people to help out. People I can trust.
You sound like the sheriff in a Western movie, deputizing the dude in the bar and the undertaker.
I guess I do, Jeremy said. Which one are you? Then, before his friend could answer, he said, But until you're the mayor, I'm the closest we got to a sheriff. And I suppose it's up to me.
I'm never going to be mayor, Jerem. I'd use all the power that comes with your title to take advantage of all the cute housewives in town.
There are cute housewives in town? Jeremy asked, glancing over at Peggy Carlson, who was at the sink, filling up water bottles.
Trick question, Jerem, since Marjorie's one of them.
Marjorie's not a housewife.
Part-time.
Okay. Can I count on you or not?
Sure thing, Sheriff.
He hung up and started to tell Mrs. Carlson what he was thinking, but she had listened to the conversation and was on board.
Good thinking, Jeremy, she said. It sounds like something your daddy would have suggested.
Well, it's not the plan yet, Peggy. Just an option.
Right,
she said, and told him to drive safe. When Jeremy went back out to the truck, there was an inch of snow frozen onto his windshield and side window. It was a fine, sandy snow now that hurt as it blew against his skin. He had to scrape the snow off so as not to ruin the wiper motor. He'd seen storms like these blow themselves out, sometimes after starting even harder than this one. But he had a feeling that the weatherman was right for once. Something in his gut was tightening, and when he looked to the east, there was nothing but gray, either sky or clouds. And visibility was so bad, it could have just been the sky a block away he was looking at. There were six main roads in town, with a couple that only had one house apiece on them. Jeremy considered going house to house, but he had a town directory at home, and it would be easier to call them. Maybe Marjorie could call some, or Mrs. Carlson could take some names too. Of course, this could all be for nothing if the storm petered out or passed over to the next valley. But an hour later, more wind, more snow. It looked like he was going to have to make a decision, and soon. He stopped by Alex Meldstrom's place and knocked on his door. He answered right away.
"Howdy, Mr. Mayor," he said,
his expression blank. Meldstrom was mayor when Jeremy was a young man, and probably held the position for 20 years, but he had always been Alex, or Bud, if you were friendly with him. Jeremy got the impression that he was criticizing him with that greeting.
"Hello, Bud," he said. "How you been?"
"Been better," the old man said.
"What do you think of this weather?"
Bud grunted.
"Somebody must have pissed off Santa Claus."
Jeremy laughed, but it was a forced reaction.
"Snowstorm's not gonna back down," Bud added.
"It looks that way."
"What can I do for you, Mayor?" Bud said again.
"I'm thinking, if it's a bad storm, we should gather everybody up and I'll see it out together."
"To keep an eye on everybody?"
"Right."
"Baptist Church?" he guessed.
"I was thinking the VFW. It's got a good heater. It..."
"That's a better pick. No benches in the way."
"Would you make a few calls? Let people know that's the plan."
"You asking or telling?"
he wanted to know. Jeremy wasn't sure where the hostility was coming from, unless Bud still longed to be mayor and resented the younger man for it. He shrugged.
"I'm asking you. You're a leader. People listen to you."
"Used to," he said,
and Jeremy shrugged again. "All right, screw the old bastard. There weren't so many folks in town, two of them couldn't gather them all."
"I can call my street," Bud said. "Next one up, if you like. When are people meeting there?"
Jeremy didn't know. "Any time, I guess. I'll see if I can't get more help gathering people, just in case there are problems." It was Bud's turn to shrug.
"I'm going to get some coffee in me. Then I'll start playing Noah."
"Noah?"
"You know, from Sunday school."
"Yeah, right. Thanks, Bud."
"No need,"
he mumbled, and then the door closed. Man, the wind was cold. The windows of Jeremy's truck were already frosted over again, and he had to scrape the windshield just to get home. No other cars were out, that he could see, that was. And the only living thing that saw him was a dog padding down the side of the road, keeping pace with him halfway down the street. He hoped that dog had a place to hunker down and wait this thing out. His small daughter opened the door for him right before he would have turned the knob.
"Snowstorm! Snowstorm!"
Mimi shouted.
"No, it's Dad,"
Jeremy said, and scooped her into his arms.
"Your hands are cold, Daddy,"
she said, wiggling in his grip. Marjorie came into the living room. She was on the phone.
"He just walked in. I'll ask him."
She put the phone down at her side and asked Jeremy,
"Addie Chittister, are you moving the town to the Veterans Hall?"
Jeremy swallowed. Addie Chittister was the most difficult woman in town, and had been a problem even in high school, when she had been Addie Bice. Mr. Chittister had turned out to be a homosexual, and only half the people in town thought he'd been one before he married Addie. There had been times when Jeremy sided with the crueler half.
"You want me to talk to her?"
he asked, dreading the answer yes.
"I'll tell her,"
Marjorie said mercifully,
"if you tell me what's going on."
"If the storm doesn't let up, we're moving everybody to the VFW. That way, everybody will be accounted for."
Marjorie raised the phone to relay that to Addie, but she had apparently heard just fine.
"She wants to know if you have enough lights and portable heaters in case the power goes out."
Jeremy opened his mouth to tell his wife to tell Addie that there was a generator, but changed his mind.
"Ask her if she'll be in charge of that. Collect some lamps, maybe kerosene heaters, or..."
Marjorie put her hand up. Across the room, he could hear Addie's voice through the phone. He hated the sound of her voice.
"She wants to know if the city will reimburse her for fuel."
"What city?"
Jeremy asked, but realized she meant the town.
"This one,"
Marjorie related, then muttered,
"She called you a moron."
Jeremy sighed. He had gone to the hall closet to gather up all the gloves he could find. It seemed that not a single one had a match. Tell her that, yes, the village will cover the costs on whatever she can provide. And she ought to call her neighbors and see if they can bring blankets and pillows, sleeping bags, cots. Carol spoke up from the living room. Jeremy hadn't seen her there, sitting in his big, easy chair.
Are we having a sleepover?
Sounds like, Marjorie told her, then went back to the phone conversation.
I'll ask him. She wants to know if you've thought of a shortwave radio, in case phones go out.
Jeremy frowned. Had never stopped frowning, actually. He held out his hand. Marjorie approached him, sympathy in her eyes. He put the phone to his ear.
Addie, he said. Anything you can think of that might help out, bring along. I appreciate you thinking out of the box on this.
Then he quickly handed the phone back to his wife. Addie said something.
I'm already here, Addie. Sure thing. I'll tell him.
She made a gesture in the air, and Jeremy had to check to see if his daughters had caught it. Both were watching TV, cartoons instead of the news.
Okay, thanks a lot,
Marjorie said, and hung up the phone.
Longest conversation you've ever had with her, Jeremy observed.
If she wanted to be mayor so much, she should have ran,
his wife grumbled.
Oh, no. Then she wouldn't be free to complain so easy,
Jeremy said, already putting it out of his mind. Even over the TV set, they could hear the wind blowing outside. The phone rang again, and Jeremy managed to delegate more phone calls and people gathering. He basically only had his own block to worry about now. With hot coffee still bubbling in his stomach, he put on some worn wool gloves, one gray and one black, and went out into the snow once again. Two of the families on his street were gone, lights out and doors locked, and another, the Waltzes, already knew about the gathering and were packing their El Dorado with quilts and sleeping bags. A cute retired couple, they seemed excited rather than nervous, and both waved him on to the next house with a smile. The wind had not let up by the last house on the block, and his ears had begun to sting. The heater in his truck was blowing full blast, and he got back to his house and left it running. Marjorie had already packed up a big cooler like they were going on a picnic, and had gotten the girls bundled up. Everything was ready to go.
You sure about this?
She asked him as he scooped up his youngest.
No, he said. Wind's still blowing hard, but there's not a lot of snow. If it doesn't get any worse, people like Addie Bice will be happy to remind me about it. Probably for the rest of my life.
Marjorie's face was unreadable. He couldn't tell if she thought he was jumping the gun or not.
Well, you can never be too cautious, right?
She said, which was supportive enough. And he kissed her on the cheek before going out into the storm. Even in a pickup truck, it was hard to stay on the road. Visibility was horrible, and Jeremy's hands were sweating, despite the ice, wind, and snow. The Legion Hall building was an ugly two-story brick right in the center of town, where the veterans of foreign wars had built it right after coming back from Germany. It had been completed in the 50s, had been expanded in the 70s, and contracted in the 90s. Essentially two large rooms with an office and kitchen on one side, and bathrooms on the other. The town used it for gatherings, for 4th of July banquets, for scouting events, and it's where the people of Little Acres voted for mayor and town council every 4 years. Jeremy had good memories of town celebrations and Halloween socials in that building, going back as long as he could remember. There were cars and trucks all around it, with no care to leave room for newcomers or who might be boxed in. Jeremy had to stop right behind a minivan to unload his children and supplies. He parked the truck halfway down the block, noticing the snow had gotten wetter on his windshield, and wondered if that was a good thing or bad. Already the vehicles were all a uniform white and gray from the layers of snow blown over them, with occasionally black tires visible. Jeremy opened the solid wooden door and was bowled over by the burst of warm air and the sound of people. It sounded like a party in there, and except for the winter clothes and lack of cocktails,
It might have been the town's founding celebration they were observing. In such a short time, the VFW was already a hotbed of activity, with half the town gathered and chattering amongst themselves. Maybe it was more than half at this point. Several friendly faces greeted him, and people shook his hand like it was a town meeting. It was a crowd, familiar faces, children, the elderly, all clustered in groups and chatting, laughing, and reminiscing throughout the hall. Folding chairs had been set out in little clusters, and one wall was lined with coats and sleeping bags. Jeremy's daughters saw him and ran through the maze of townsfolk to get to him. He noticed the water tracked in and all around the entrance, and thought it would be difficult to find volunteers to clean the building after all this was done. He peeled off his jacket and scooped up his youngest into his arms, asking where her mother was. She pointed, and he saw the back of her head, chatting with a couple other wives, folding blankets while another jotted in a notebook who they belonged to. There was a big, heavy-looking television set up against the far wall of the hall, and the news was showing snowstorm coverage, currently highlighting a fatal accident on the southbound freeway less than an hour before. Luke Smithson stood up from beside the TV when he noticed Jeremy's daughters run by. He met the mayor's eye and signaled him over, meeting him halfway.
"Getting thicker out there," Jeremy said as he approached him.
"Temperature's dropped 5 degrees since I opened the place up," Luke said.
"I appreciate you doing this," Jeremy said,
feeling a bit awkward about the whole thing, even though Luke was his good friend and wouldn't require any thanks.
"That's all right. There were a couple of houses nobody answered the door at," he said, leaning a bit closer to be heard over all the people.
Jeremy could smell beer on his breath.
"Any lights on? Cars in the yard?"
"No. Must have been out of town," Luke guessed. "I just called and left a message at those two."
"That's fine. There was one house that looked empty on my street, too."
"Gang's all here,"
someone said next to Jeremy. It was Bud Melstrom, walking up, a manila envelope in his hand.
"Yeah? Everybody make it in okay?"
"Pretty much," Bud said. "Guess you get to make sure."
Bud handed him the envelope, which held the town directory from 10 years back, when Bud had been mayor.
"You want a call roll, teacher?"
Jeremy nearly declined, but nodded and looked around for a good place to talk to everyone. Luke wandered back to his spot by the television. He had always been scared of Bud, who used to pay him to work on the Meldstrom farm, but called him shiftless and berated his performance until Luke wouldn't go anymore. The door opened and Peggy Carlson and her grandkids came in. Peggy's arms were full and her nose red from the cold. She had probably had to load everything up herself, the poor woman. Jeremy greeted her, gave her grandson the stink eye, and walked to the center of the hall.
"Can I have everybody's attention, please?" he called, then repeated, loud enough to be heard in the other half of the building.
Luke turned the sound down on the television, and people halted their conversations to hear what Jeremy had to say. He held up the envelope.
"Bud has a city directory from a few years back, so I'm going to go down the list, calling people's names. If you know where somebody on here is, speak up. But we want to make sure everybody is accounted for."
People stayed quiet, except for the occasional baby, and irritatingly, a yapping little dog somebody had brought. Jeremy read through the directory, getting an unusual amount of laughter for the names of people who'd moved away or died. While he was taking roll, two more families arrived, and he made a note of it. Several folks were out of town or absent when someone went to their door, and it wasn't until he got to Peter Trudy that there was complete silence from the crowd. Actually, the silence only lasted a second or two. Then there was a gasp, a chuckle, and a child distinctly saying,
"Ugly Trudy Pitter."
Jeremy swallowed. At the sound of that nickname, his heart began to beat faster. It was a name he'd not thought of in years. Of course she still lived in town. He was aware of that, but he hadn't had any dealings with her. Nobody had. And she lived on the very outskirts of town, where the only neighbors were deer and pine trees. People didn't even take that road to get to the canyon anymore, now that there was the bigger two-lane road on the north side of town.
Jeremy Cooper had been at the door of that house exactly once, more than 20 years before. He hadn't actually met the owner of that house, but had instead run like a bat out of hell down the steps, down the driveway, and out the gate. Jeremy cleared his throat. He put his hands up, trying to quiet everybody down.
Did nobody go over there?
Of course no one had.
Or call her?
Nope.
Anybody know her?
Jeremy asked. He scanned the crowd, stopping on Bud Meldstrom. But the old man looked away.
Anybody seen Trudy Pitter lately?
Anybody ever see her?
Carlos Eggett said, and some laughed at that. Jeremy let the laughter die out.
Right. Okay, so who knows her? Any of you speak to her? I mean, are on speaking terms with her?
No one spoke.
Who has their cell phone here? Would somebody give her a call to let her know what's happening?
Nobody stepped forward.
I don't have a signal,
someone said, and then they all agreed with her. The sound of the wind could be heard from outside, above the scooting chairs, coughs and mumbles, the children chattering.
There's a phone in the office, Bud said.
Will you give her a call?
Jeremy asked. Bud shrugged. He stepped up, took the sheet of paper with her information on it, and Jeremy continued his roll call. By the time he got through, Bud had returned, handing back the paper.
Number's no good, he said quietly. Been disconnected.
Jeremy cursed under his breath. Ugly Trudy was infamous. It seemed impossible she'd been forgotten. More likely, she had been deliberately ignored. But he had forgotten about her, quite legitimately. Hadn't he? He gave Bud Meldstrom as broad a smile as he could manage, and began,
I wonder, Bud, if you could...
Awfully cold out there, Mayor,
Bud said. And was that a hint of a smile at his lips? Did he know Jeremy's history with ugly Trudy Pitter? That she was pretty much the only person in town Jeremy feared?
That's true. But somebody's got to warn her.
Interlude 1. The legend of Trudy Pitter, now just Ugly Trudy, had been around all his life. She was a wealthy landowner's daughter, and a local legend that every kid growing up in Little Acres knew the history of. Back in the 50s, or maybe it was the early 60s, Trudy Lynn Pitter had been the most beautiful girl in town. Maybe the world. Jeremy's father had known her. Of course, everybody in the area knew her, and everyone else. And had harbored a crush on her, at least for a while. She had had a lovely voice and was fond of singing, but it was her face that everyone remembered. There had been talk of her moving to Hollywood to get her face on the silver screen, or at least on TV. But those plans had been cut short when she was 17, and had stumbled and gone face first into a thresher, one of those motorized fancy lawnmowers that cleared entire fields. She hadn't died, and the doctors had saved her sight somehow, but from that day on, Trudy Pitter had put away any aspirations of celebrity, and her many suitors in town and the surrounding areas had fled like one does from a plague carrier. She never moved to Hollywood, and still lived on her parents' farm, where she stayed behind a tall gate and only went out once in a long while, then wearing a dark veil like a widow at a funeral. She did become famous, though. Famous as Ugly Trudy, whose face was so hideous anyone who looked upon it would lose their mind. A stupid story, maybe, at least at first. But as the years went by, there were townsfolk who had had nervous breakdowns, or mental breaks, and it was blamed on looking at Trudy Pitter's face. Children in elementary school knew the story in Jeremy's day, and he had no doubt that his daughters knew the story as well. He wasn't sure how many of them believed the tale,
A silly story, if there ever was one. But Jeremy did. When he was 14, his best friend Chad dared Jeremy to cross her gate, go to the door, knock, and ask Ugly Trudy for a glass of water. Jeremy had refused. Chad and his older brother Andy had each put up $25, which really meant something in 1986, as a reward for doing the deed. They'd driven Jeremy up to the gate, dropped him off, and watched from a safe distance. Jeremy hadn't believed the stories. Who could? But had found his pulse quickening and his legs trembling as he forced himself to walk up her path and toward the door. She had flowers planted all along her house, not just tulips and marigolds, but roses and orchids, which didn't grow too well in town. He walked up the steps and felt his bladder tightening up. There was sweat at the small of his back, and his breathing was coming fast and hard. "This is bullshit," he thought aloud, and rang her bell. He glanced behind him and saw the two brothers waving and making scared gestures his way. The stupid jerks. But what if she opened the door? And she was horrible, like a skull with only scar tissue over it, something he'd remember for the rest of his life. What if she grabbed at him and he saw that face in his dreams until he really did go crazy? There was a click as the inner door started to open. There was still a screen door between him and Ugly Trudy Pitter. Between him and madness. Suddenly, he had to get out of there. He didn't need $50. He needed to get free and didn't care what his friends said. He turned and heard a woman's voice say, "Yes." Jeremy ran as hard and as fast as he could, making it to the Pitter gate in 2 seconds flat. His face was red and there were tears in his eyes, and he nearly screamed when Andy held the gate closed so he couldn't get out. He could imagine the woman's hand grasping his arm and turning him around so she could look him in the eye, Medusa-like. But of course, Andy and Chad would have seen her first if she had come out of the house. Instead, they were laughing hysterically at his unreasonable terror, and when they finally let him out, he had a new nickname, Pitter Patter. It had been humiliating, sure, but at the junior high, and the next fall at the high school, nobody else had ever even gotten that close to her, so Jeremy became something of an expert. "What did you see? Did she talk to you? What did her voice sound like? Was there a smell?" He was embarrassed at his cowardice, although few kids in town would ever dare get that far, but also disappointed he didn't have a better story to tell, with juicy details and observations. Mayor Jeremy stood in the center of the Legion Hall, most of the townsfolk no longer looking at him, talking with Bud Meldstrom. Bud had just commented on how cold it was outside right now. "That's true," Jeremy said, aware of all the white beating at the windows, eager to get in. "But somebody's got to warn her."
"Warn whom?"
Addie Chittister asked from the wall. Had she been standing there the whole time, scrutinizing his every word and movement? Jeremy hadn't noticed her there, though that too seemed unlikely, as unlikely as him forgetting about the monster that lived west of town.
"Ugly,"
Jeremy began, then stopped himself.
"It seems nobody thought to warn Trudy Pitter."
"Ah,"
Addie said, raising her eyebrows.
"To warn her, or to bring her here?"
"She does live in town."
"Barely,"
Addie said. Bud chimed in.
"She don't leave that house. Least not that I know about."
"Well, we should give her the chance to come down here," Jeremy said, though he wasn't convinced of his own words. "Right?"
"Seems so," Bud mused. "You volunteering?"
Addie chuckled nastily. She probably knew no other way of laughing.
"There's the problem, Jeremy. Nobody really wants her here, do they? Not even you."
"But she's old, she..."
Jeremy thought about the storm in his father's day. The dead.
"She could be scared. In trouble."
"Shoes on the other foot, then,"
Addie said coldly. And Jeremy found himself hating her, even though she had spoken his exact thoughts.
Look, Bud said, almost too loudly. If you want to ask for a volunteer to go gather her, be my guest, but...
He put up his finger and lowered his voice.
Might not be a good idea for the rest of us.
You don't believe that story, do you? Jeremy said, hypocritically. He didn't like playing devil's advocate, but he also didn't want any deaths on his hands.
Haven't got an opinion one way or another, the old man said. But some round these parts do. Seems like you used to be quite a believer, too.
Jeremy couldn't respond to that. In a small town, everybody's business was common knowledge. Jeremy looked around. Where was Luke Smithson when he needed him? He was back in front of the television, which was no longer on mute. Raoul Waltz, his neighbor, was a few chairs away from him, both watching the weather coverage. He was torn, but didn't want to act like it. If it had been an old farmer or a kid out there, people would be stumbling over each other to get to them. But one silly curse. One purported silly curse.
We could...
Jeremy clammed up as his wife Marjorie stepped up to them, Peggy Carlson at her side. They had been close for years now. Peggy had a package of Chips Ahoy cookies and offered Jeremy one. He devoured it in one bite and felt Marjorie put her hand on his back.
What's the town meeting about?
Nothing, Jeremy started to say, before being interrupted by Addie saying,
Ugly Trudy Pitter. Oh my God, nobody warned her?
Marjorie said. Jeremy was very relieved to hear her concern.
Someone will go out and bring her here. Don't worry, Jeremy said.
Then Marjorie pursed her lips. She actually took a step back.
Bring her here? No, warn her, but not bring her here.
My thought exactly, Bud said.
Jeremy began. She lives in this town.
Barely, said his wife.
Shouldn't she get to choose what to do? Marjorie swallowed.
But the children, what if...
Addie Chittister announced.
Let's put it to a vote, shall we?
Jeremy scowled, no more thrilled to be second-guessed by Addie than he had been the last 50 times she'd done it.
Look, I'm the mayor. We don't need to vote.
Then ask for a volunteer, why don't you?
No, Bud said. He's the mayor. He should go up there and talk to her.
Jeremy ground his teeth. He guessed Bud felt like he had it coming. But Jeremy hadn't meant it like that. He took a deep breath and let it out slowly.
That's right, he said finally. I'll go.
You shouldn't,
Peggy Carlson said. He met her eyes, surprised that someone so level-headed, and in her 70s, could believe all the stories. There was concern in them. Concern for him.
It's a big house, Mayor. Sturdy. She's never needed anybody's help before, so she's probably fine now.
Yeah, well, we've got to check.
Marjorie had said nothing for a minute or so. Now she said,
Jeremy, could I talk to you for a minute?
Bud was peering out the nearest window.
Looks like the wind has let up. Better get yourself bundled, Mayor.
Marjorie Cooper physically took her husband aside.
What is going on?
Before Jeremy could explain, she said,
He almost seemed to be daring you to go out there.
Guess he knows about me and dares,
Jeremy all but whispered.
Ignore him,
she said, her voice steely, like she was giving one of her children an order.
You're needed here. You're in charge of this group.
People can be in charge of themselves while I'm gone.
Your girls need you,
Marjorie pleaded.
I need you.
He nodded. I know. I'll hurry.
She grabbed onto his arm, squeezing so hard he thought her nails would have broken the skin had he been wearing short sleeves.
Don't go, Jeremy. Please.
Another person stood behind him, pulling on his arm. It was Luke Smithson.
You're thinking about bringing Ugly Trudy here?
He asked, way too loudly. A child looked up at that. Jeremy recognized the terror in his eyes. He supposed some people still told the stories, still sang the little rhyme that went, Ugly Trudy Pitter, her face is bitter. Bud Meldstrom walked past, passing Jeremy his coat. Then he walked away, saying nothing. Look, I'm going to give her the chance to come here. Jeremy put the coat on, one sleeve, then the other, in case she needs to.
Just call her, Luke said.
Phone's not working.
She's got a big house, an estate. She'll be fine, he argued.
She will,
Marjorie agreed.
Come on and sit down for a while. We'll get some hot chocolate in you and...
This was absurd. Marjorie and his friends were manipulating him to stay, while Bud and Addie Bice were doing the same thing to get him to leave. Jeremy snorted.
Please, stop all this. If I don't go, and something happens to her, I'll be responsible.
The storm's responsible, Jeremy, began Peggy.
We all will be, he finished.
He pulled his gloves from his coat pocket and started putting them on.
Better safe than sorry, Mayor,
an older woman said from a chair half the room away. He didn't even know who she was at that angle.
I'll get back as soon as I can.
Jeremy zipped up his jacket and started for the door.
Get someone to go with you,
Marjorie said, desperation in her voice. He hated to hear it there. She didn't seem to understand that he wanted to stay here, where it was safe and relatively warm.
Everybody,
Bud announced. All eyes turned to him.
Mayor Cooper is going over to Ms. Pitter's place to see if she's okay.
More gasps and chatter at that.
Anybody wish to go with him?
Nobody volunteered. The most audible voice was a cowboy-hatted guy against the wall who said,
Shit, no.
Jeremy went to the door. He unexpectedly had to go to the bathroom. His own body had turned against him. He considered stopping by the restroom first, but thought better of it. Procrastinating would be so easy, like an alcoholic taking just one more drink. He turned the doorknob and heard Mimi, his youngest, say,
Daddy?
He pulled open the door and was pelted with little ice crystals and wind. He managed to get out and close the door behind him, then peered through the stinging cold for his truck. The sky was gray, but everything else was white. He had to scrape his windshield and driver's side window as it was already coated with a half-frozen slushy film. He wondered if the vehicle would even start, almost hoping that it wouldn't for the first time since he'd bought it. But it roared to life, and the heater started immediately, still blowing warm air. It was normally only a 2-minute drive to the most remote end of town, but it took him nearly 10. He had a lot of thoughts to keep him company on the drive, even though Night Ranger and Genesis were playing on the radio.
So that's where we're going to end for today. Sorry, I've got these little sticker weeds, sticking into the bottom of my shoes. Holy smoke. I'm scuffing them. I'm trying to get them off, and they won't come off. I'll probably have to cut this part out, but I wanted an explanation for why my feet are making such a terrible noise. This lake used to be just filthy. Holy cow, it was terrible. Some carpet got into it, and the carpet just bred and bred and bred and bred until it was filthy brown water, and the carp would just breed so much that any other kind of fish would be pushed out. And carp are their bottom dwellers, bottom feeders, bottom something. And so whenever they'd swim, they'd drudge up the muck at the bottom of the water and the mud. And so it was a big brown lake, much like what I'm looking at right now. Ooh. But the last couple of years, they decided they would come out here and they would catch all of the carp. So they came out with big nets, and they just scooped them up, and they took all the carp out, and they turned it into dog food, I believe. It might have been cat food, but I think I remember them saying they were going to turn the carp into dog food, and they were catching them by the tons, you know, just like 12,000 carp caught this week or whatever. And just in a number of like 3 years, 4 years, the color of the water has changed. Now, right here where I'm standing, it's brown and ugly as hell. But out there, it's blue. It's pretty. And I know there are still carp out there and they're still trying to eliminate them. But they've introduced other kinds of fish as well that are, you know, edible fish, that are cleaner fish. And they want this place to be less smelly and less disgusting and more of a, not a tourist trap, but a place where people can go and look at nature and feel at one with Poseidon. I don't know. So I just figured I'd say that's the end of the episode. So Stormy Weather is a story that I wrote 2 years ago, about 2014. I was in that notebook. Well, I have several notebooks, but I would always carry a notebook with me, and it's hard for me to differentiate them. I just say the notebook. And I wrote it longhand, of course. And then it wasn't until now, 2016, that I got that notebook out and I typed up the story and recorded it. And now you've listened to it. The funny thing is, I mean, I remembered the story well enough. I remembered writing the story. There are some where I'm just like, what? What is that? I can't remember what inspired the story. Well, that's a lie. I can't remember what inspired this particular version of the story, but years ago, when I was still living in Los Angeles, I came back for Christmas, and Big had just moved from California, and he had a house, a new house, and he invited me to come over and see his house and hang out with him, and I hadn't seen him really. There was one time I'd driven up to Sacramento. Big and I, we went to college together. We were friends in college, but we weren't like the best of friends. We became close-ish friends our senior year when I discovered how much he liked Star Wars, and we would hang out and we liked music together, and we both loved Sting. He wanted to be a writer, and I was like, wow, I have a lot in common with this guy. He's all right. But it was my senior year when I was about to graduate and move off to California. And so just as we would have become good friends, I moved away. But luckily, we sent emails back and forth. And through these emails, we became closer than we ever had been when we lived near one another. I wish that I had gone to visit him in Sacramento, but I didn't. I saw him once. I went to his station where he worked. I think he worked for ABC there in Sacramento. And he showed me his edit bay and showed me his wiener. We hung out, and that it was just, you know, an afternoon in all the years that I lived in LA, you know. As far as I know, he never came down to LA, and I certainly never went up to Sacramento. It was a long drive. I'd say it was like 6 hours to get up there. Maybe I'm remembering wrong, but that's what I remember. Anyway, he invited me to come see his new house, and I didn't have much time, but I drove out there. I tried to find it. I think he gave me a map or not, you know, he was on the phone saying, okay, now turn left. Okay, tell me what you see. And it was snowing, and there was a little bit of wind blowing. It was cold. I made it to his house, and I was like, wow, the snow is really coming down out there. And he said, yeah, I didn't think that you would make it. On the news, they're talking about, you know, this being the storm of the century, a big snowstorm, like, unlike the world has ever known. No. You know, they killed the dinosaurs, and now it's going to kill us. And, so, you know, I was in his house and looking around, saying hi, meeting his kids. I think I had known the littlest one. Sorry, I had known the oldest one when he was little, but he had a bunch of kids since then, or two more, or something like that. Meanwhile, you could hear the wind, and the snow was coming down like crazy outside, and Big's wife said, you know, the news is saying you can't travel. If you're wherever you are, just stay. You know, it's a blizzard out there. And he's like, oh, okay, do you want to spend the night? And I didn't. I said, oh, you know, I wanted to get home. You know, I see my family and all this happy crappy. And he says, are you sure? Because they're saying it's really, really bad weather. And it was. But I got in the car and I drove very slowly back home and I made it. I survived. And you said that only proves that I'm insane. And anyway, we talked about that for a while after. Over the years, we talked about this snowstorm, this crazy snowstorm, where they said, you know, stay in your homes. And Big's town, the town that he had moved to, was so small that I don't know how many people lived there, but my guess was around 300 or 400 people lived there. And now it's probably 5,000 or 6,000. It's quadrupled. No, it's way more. It's 10 or so times as big as it was. But it was a little town that was created, incorporated in like 2003 or 2 or something like that. So that's how new his town was. And now it's just gotten bigger and bigger. They've got a grocery store. They've got a bunch of brothels. It's beautiful. But we've talked a bunch of times, Big and I, about what if I had been forced to spend the night. You know, what if there was something supernatural that was going on? What if, the idea that I really liked was, what if he and I weren't friends and I was forced to spend the night at his house? You know, you're forced to spend the night with someone you despise. And that to me was an interesting idea. And we kicked it around. I really wanted to write it as an audio drama for the Doonstief. We did this one. We were going to make a short film called The Spirit of Christmas. And we never made it as a short film, but we made it as a sort of an audio drama, and it's available on the Doonstief. I'd say that I'd put it in the show notes, but I will not remember. You can go find that, though. And then as a follow-up to Spirit of Christmas, I thought, well, it's another holiday story. We'll do this snowstorm story. And basically what it was going to be, and I may still write it, but it's doubtful because I wanted it to be our story, something that we wrote together. The plane is just right above me. It's pretty cool. I wonder what it would be like to fly in a little plane like that. We come up with a couple ideas every once in a while together. And I feel weird if I just go ahead and write that by myself, because the idea was ours. I meant it as a collaboration, and it's never going to be the same story if I write it by myself than if I wrote it with Big. And so that story never got written, the snowstorm story. But it may still someday. In the meantime, though, here is a snowstorm story that I've written, and it's probably based on that experience with Big. The mayor, Mayor Cooper, Jeremy, I guess was his name. I don't know where that comes from. I just wanted a first-person guy, a guy that was a decent guy, to be the protagonist and that. And this was meant to be a short story, really short, because it was all going to be about ugly Trudy Pitter and Jeremy. You know, if I had that notebook in front of me, I could share with you my notes. And I wish I had read through them, because that would have been useful to say, okay, this was the inspiration. This is what I wrote, and this is when I wrote it. Sometimes I would date those things when they were like journal entries of, oh, I had an interesting idea for a story. But I think the premise was, there's a kid who encountered a witch in the town, you know, as a kid. And then as an adult, he's mayor of the town, or he's sheriff, one or the other, I'm sure. And there's a terrible snowstorm, and he decides to gather everybody, or all the whole town is gathering together in the church or in the VFW is what happened in this story. And he realizes that nobody has gone to warn the witch. And he has to bury his fears and go out and talk to the witch. That was the premise of the story. I like to write about witches. I grew up in a very small town, about 1,000 people. It was a farming community. This town that I've written about in this story is sort of a combination of his town and my town, a smaller version of my town, I guess, you know, if there were just farmers. And I remember it being a little kid, and probably kindergarten. We used to walk to school in those days. I know it makes me sound like I'm ancient. But there was a house, you know, one of those big scary houses, a house that was built in 1900 or whatever, where an old lady lived. And of course the kindergartners, or maybe it was like the third graders, would tell the first graders, and the first graders would tell the kindergartners that the woman that lived in that house was a witch. And that's something that fascinated me as a little kid. It's just, oh, there's a witch that lives in our town? And of course, you know, if my parents heard it, they would have none of it. They didn't go for that kind of talk. And my mom's from Mexico, and her mother had a little bit of superstition in her, and I don't think that my mom tolerated much of that. I mean, except for the normal superstition of, you know, what you reap what you sow, that kind of thing. Anyhow, I was fascinated by that idea of a witch living in our town, or a haunted house, a house that everybody knows is haunted. And, you know, it's a childhood fear of the unknown, of the mysterious, of you know, that. And that's sort of where that came from. And I've written about that a number of times. There's a story called Like a Good Neighbor that I wrote. And I'd like to do it on the show, except for all of the characters. You know, except for maybe one bit part. All of them are female. The main protagonist is female. The main antagonist is female. There's the mother. There's a sister. They're all female. And maybe I'll do that. But I think it would be better if I had a female narrator on that, if I could give that to Renee Chambliss or something and have her do it. It feels like a lot to ask. And I don't know, maybe that's crazy. Maybe if you are listening and you're a female, you'd be like, oh, I'd love to do that. I'd love to be able to produce that. And in which case, yeah, let me know. But I wrote a story called Like a Good Neighbor where there's a little girl and she discovers that her next door neighbor is a witch. And that's not all. I mean, I've written many stories about witches. Not many, but it's something that comes up over and over again. Not that Ugly Trudy Pitter is a witch. She's just sort of a, what do you call it? An extension of that, of the woman that lives by herself in a house that's supposed to be haunted or that the kids are all afraid of, that kind of thing. That to me is just fascinating. The idea, see, all the planes that take off from this little airport are tiny. Like two-seaters. Personal aircraft. I don't know what you call them. Anyhow, if this is split into two, this is where I will leave you for today. I know I've talked for a while, but, you know, I don't want to talk your ear off. That's ironic, isn't it, coming from me? But anyhow, I will be back soon with the other half of the story. And thank you for listening. And, take care. Oh, the Rishoutcast. It's produced under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. I don't know why, but apparently that means that you can copy it, you can share it with whomever you like. You just can't alter the file. You can't edit it, you can't sell it, you can't pretend that it's yours. Why would you want to pretend that it's yours, children? Ugh. Keeps raining all the time. Okay, so that's where I'm going to cut the episode in two. And if I don't cut the episode in two, then we can lose a lot of this bullcrap. In fact, let me have this sentence in here if we don't cut it in two. So, I edited the story, and it wasn't as long as I thought it would be. So I just went ahead, and we've just got one episode for stormy weather. I hope you don't mind that it's long. Okay.